On November 4th, 2019, in Tippecanoe High School's Center for Performing Arts, the Tip City Public Library, in partnership with the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, held a presentation by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Gilbert King. King discussed his nonfiction books, Devil in the Grove, Thurgood Marshall, Groveland Boys, and The Dawn of a New America. Students had the opportunity to interview King for a podcast. The students were Katie Reeder, London Eberly, Megan Haggerty, and Elise Cooper.
I am Megan Haggerty, a senior at Tippecanoe High School in Ohio. Today I have the honor of interviewing Gilbert King about his life and his novel, Devil in the Grove, on Dayton's Youth Radio.
This is Katie Reeder recording for Dayton Youth Radio from Tippecanoe High School. I am here with Gilbert King to ask a few questions about his Pulitzer Prize-winning work, Devil in the Grove. Welcome, Mr. King.
The first question is, you have told these stories of many African Americans, and I'm just curious as to how you connect with these stories or these people in your stories.
Well, the sad part about it is, for the most part, everybody in my stories is usually dead. So I'm really dealing with a lot of documents. Every once in a while, I get to interview somebody young who lived through these experiences. But it's just, to me, it's been a really enlightening experience to actually be able to go back and you know, file these Freedom of Information Act requests and get these documents. And these reports really have been buried for 60, 70 years. And so a lot of times when I'm doing it, I'm the first person to open these envelopes. And, you know, there's times when bullets come out of the envelopes. There's reports that have been sealed for 65 years. And I feel this great privilege of actually being able to understand what really happened, because the cases are oftentimes buried. And so now, all of a sudden, like, I become the first person to read this. It's like, it's almost like, you know, waking up on Christmas morning when you're a kid and just, what's in this next box? And sometimes the things that are in these documents are profoundly moving, and they really solve puzzles in the story. So my connections are generally, especially with, you know, Devil in the Grove, my connections are usually with the documents. But there are some times where I run into people who have lived through things and I can interview them. And I guess the one thing I've learned most is that people really love to talk about things, because sometimes no one's ever asked them these questions. And when they can tell that you're sincere and that you really care about this, they're willing to talk. Maybe, I don't know if you've, you know, recognize a lot of people, like during World War II, soldiers would come back and they didn't really want to talk about what they saw. You know, it was a very traumatic thing to be exposed to a war and some of the things you've seen. How do you bring that back to the civilian world and talk about that? And I find it's kind of the same when you're writing about race and maybe police brutality or injustice. There are stories that people didn't want to talk about because they can poison you in a lot of ways. And you don't want your children exposed to these stories. You want your children to have maybe a decent start at learning about the world. And so a lot of times I find that the people I speak to just never really shared this with other people. I've had people in my book saying, I never saw a picture of my uncle until I read your book. We just didn't have those pictures out, and we didn't talk about them. They didn't know the stories themselves. But it's been a cathartic experience, and I think once people start to read and start to learn the stories, then they want to know more, and they want to really understand it, and they feel a little bit bad about not having known these stories for so long.
So you spent a lot of time in Florida during your college years. Did that inspire you or give you more insight into the stories that you later wrote focusing in Florida?
You know, actually, no. I mean, it's just a coincidence that I was there at the time. The coincidence is so remarkable because, you know, I went to college thinking I was going to be a baseball player, and I just was in way over my head. The team was way too good, and I realized that was kind of the end of my baseball career. I just wasn't good enough. And so it was like plan B time. I had to think, what am I going to do now? And it was in the days before the internet, so I would go to the library a lot, and I just became a voracious reader. And I think part of it was probably just depression. I was like, that whole baseball thing not working out, what do I do now? And I really started becoming a reader. And I started learning about the world through books and newspapers, and I spent so much time in that library. And I find it really ironic that, you know, decades later, I'm back in that same library because they have the same collections of governor's papers. And this is the place I spent when I was like 19, 20 years old. And here I am, middle-aged guy, and I'm back in the library, the same exact library that I spent in my youth. And here I am doing research for a book. And so I don't know. I find that just like such a crazy story. But my early days at Florida really didn't have anything to do with it. When I stumbled upon this case, you know, I knew I wanted to do this story, and it just happened to be in Florida. So,
I heard that you were the MC at the Dayton Gala last night, at the Dayton Literary Peace Prize Gala. How was that?
You know, it's just an honor to do it. I feel like my job in that is to sort of move people through so that we get to the next introduction and introduce the next author who's going to make an acceptance speech for his award. So it's just an honor to be part of it. I love the fact that they keep asking me to come back because I have the greatest time there. Sometimes I do these panels with the authors, and there'll be 8 great authors sitting there, and I'm at the end, and I'm thinking, wow, this is a really great panel. I'm like, wait, I'm on this panel. But I lose myself in it because the writers are so great, and it's just great to listen to them. And so the whole weekend is really just incredibly special. It's like nothing else I've ever been to for any kind of literary event, any book festival. This is clearly by far the best one I've ever been to, and everybody that comes out of here will tell you the same.
What was the research process like when you were writing Devil in the Grove? Who did you interview? What papers did you read? Where did you visit?
The first thing I did was I filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the National Archives, and they keep all the FBI files. And that took years to get. Because what happens is when you file this Freedom of Information Act request, it needs to be vetted and redacted so that names are crossed out at certain times, and it takes a long time. And I'm talking about, you know, a big box of files, lots of FBI reports. It takes people going through this. And so I remember I would call up, I'd put in my request, I'd call every month, and they would say, Mr. King, you're number 200 in the queue. I said, okay, didn't even know what that meant. I call back a month later, they say, you're now 196. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, this is going to take a long time. Every month I'd call back to find out the progress. And, you know, it was getting down to like 160 and 150. And I'm like, I have a deadline. I got to, you know, this is going to take years. And I remember one time I called. This was, I think, after about a year I called. And they said, oh, Mr. King, today's your lucky day. I was like, wow, did I crack the top 100? And they said, no, after 60 years, all of this becomes public domain. So it doesn't need to be redacted anymore. So I said, what does that mean? And they said, you can come down tomorrow. We're just going to dump boxes on you, and nothing's redacted. And so that's exactly what happened. And so I went down there. So I'm the first person to see these files. And I realized that everything that happens in this story is documented by the FBI. Mm-hmm. They went in and interviewed the deputies, and the deputies are like, telling exactly what happened. Oh, yeah, we took those guys in the basement and beat them up, and then they confessed. And it's all right there in the documents. And they're naming names, and the stories are there. And I'm like thinking, at one point, one of the comments was, the FBI report said, off the record, the deputy told me that it was him and somebody else who did this thing down in the basement, and softened them up for the confessions. And I remember thinking, like, who's so stupid that they think they're going off the record with an FBI agent? Mm-hmm. But the truth is, they were kind of off the record because these reports never saw the light of day. Mm-hmm. They were always considered investigations still in progress. And so they were just basically sealed and thrown away in the files. And so the truths were just buried. And that was the most disturbing part of it. One of the words in the report, one of the FBI agents was like, just, you know, he wanted the sheriff prosecuted. He wanted to go after these guys, and it was all quashed. And he wrote in his report, he said he was told that it was quashed for the tranquility of the South. In other words, if people really knew what was happening, they might riot in the streets. And I remember those 4 words, tranquility of the South. Like, what does that have to do with anything? Like, get this out there. But it was buried. And so that's the great thing in the research process for me, is just going back and finding these original documents that haven't been seen by anybody, and realizing that the story is all right there and just no one's known it.
Hearing all your stories about how you've tried to grow yourself and to become this person that has won a Pulitzer Prize and been invited to the Dayton Literary Peace Prize Gala so many years in a row, it's really inspiring to hear. Like, do you have anything that would help me so I don't stop writing or try and keep pushing through just in case it gets hard?
You know, it's definitely going to get hard, and it doesn't, I mean, it gets hard for me. I mean, right now you think like, well, you must have all these ideas, but it's not like that. This whole business is really hard. It's sometimes you have a great, great story, but it's not enough there to sustain a book. It might be a great feature-length story, but you just don't have the characters or you don't have the primary resources. And I'm talking about nonfiction. I think with novels, you know, I think one of the things that, you know, I was sitting there listening to Richard Powers last night, who wrote the book The Overstory, won the Pulitzer Prize this year for that book. And, you know, I'm doing civil rights. I'm writing about this pre-civil rights area and lawyers. And here's a man who's talking about trees and writing about trees and the impact in the environment. And you can just see how much passion he puts into his writing and his research. And so you jump around from each author last night, and you can just see everyone has a different passion, and it's what moves them. And I think that's the most important thing. I don't ever want to work for 5 years on a book that I think, well, maybe it's a good idea and maybe it'll sell. But if it doesn't mean anything to me, I have to live with this story for 4 or 5 years. And it's a tremendous amount of investment to be able to say this, I care about this. But that's the kind of thing you need to have this so it's obsessing you at night and you're waking up in the middle of the night and writing down notes because you cannot stop thinking about it. It can't be a lot of fun to be around people like that, but no, I'm joking. But I think that's the thing, is just to find something you're really interested in. Maybe it's just characters if you want to write a novel, and characters who are exposed to some kind of conflict that you want to see it resolved, and it's all happening in your head. You're in charge of these characters. And I have a lot of novelist friends who write books and they just put them in drawers for a couple of years, and maybe they'll revisit it later and use some of the themes because their writing hasn't developed yet. And it's hard to know that. You know, sometimes I think it gets really frustrating. People start writing and they say, this is really hard. I don't know if I'm good enough. I don't know enough about the world. I'm too young. And, sometimes that's true. Sometimes you just need to really think about the themes you want to write about, and maybe it'll come to you later. But the idea of just sitting down and practicing and learning about yourself as a writer, it's a lifelong process. I mean, I can tell you when I sit down, there's many times where I look at this and go, I am really just not a good writer. So what am I good at? I'm good at research. I'm good at trying to find these stories. And then after a while, you say, I want to tell the stories about what I've learned, and that gets you excited about writing because, like, I've learned all this stuff, now I have to tell people about it. And you sort of have to trick yourself into it a lot of times. But, you know, again, persistence, and just, you know, sometimes I think that there's a lot of people out there who just cannot imagine themselves doing anything but writing. And so sometimes it really takes that kind of commitment and discipline. And I think I'm in that stage right now where I can't wait to work on the next story, something new, something to challenge myself.
What was the experience of winning the Pulitzer Prize like? How has this changed your career as a writer now?
You know, I don't even think I really fully understood it when it happened. I wasn't paying attention. This book, like I said, I got this letter saying it's going out of print, and it's not a successful book. And so I didn't pay attention when the literary awards were. I couldn't even get this book reviewed. You know, like, it was just, I thought it was just going to disappear. And then, like lightning out of the sky, this happens. And it's just kind of overwhelming to see how things change. The one most important thing, I think, for me, was that I didn't think I'd ever be able to do another book like this kind of story, because if I did two of them at this point and no one bought them, it wasn't getting any interest, you know, how much more can you keep doing this? After the Pulitzer, I feel like the great gift that's been given to me is that I can still write these stories. These are the stories that matter to me, and I feel like I have now a little bit more clout, I guess, to say that this is the story I want to pursue, and I want to write these stories, and there'll be a little bit more attention, and I'll be able to do it. Before, I think, if I hadn't won the Pulitzer, I don't think I would have written another book. I think it would have been over. It would have been really hard to sell me as an author who was worth investing in.
What do you do if you ever, like, sitting on a panel, like you said, and you see all these other amazing authors? Do you ever feel kind of inferior to them, or that, like, you're not as good of a writer as they might be?
I feel it all the time. And the truth of the matter is, I'm correct Most everybody I come across is a much better writer than me. I kind of know what I do well, but I don't think I'm a beautiful writer. Listening to Richard Powers and Bob Shakosius and Golnaz last night, I realized these are gifted writers with words, and I'm that's not my strength. Okay, I'm not going to write a lyrical, beautiful book. But I do know that by telling stories and getting out of the way of my stories, that's how I approach it. I just want to be as minimalist and let the stories themselves speak for themselves. And now, granted, there's a lot of other parts of writing. Now, maybe I might not be the most lyrical and use the most beautiful words. However, I feel like what I do know about is constructing a story and building suspense. And you know, this is nonfiction, but that doesn't mean that you can't be creative. You don't have to tell these linearly or chronologically. You can jump around a little bit. As long as you're not, you know, misrepresenting the material, I'm always sticking to the facts. I document everything. I have sources in the back. But I still have the power as a creative writer to use different techniques that novelists use, structurally, cliffhangers at the end of a chapter, maybe going off on a tangent here and there. I can use all those techniques, and so, but I do. I mean, when I'm on these panels, I just feel very inferior to the and I'm not wrong. They are really beautiful writers, but you know, I also know that my strengths, what they are, and that, I think that's an important thing to understand. If I was to go out and try to write a beautiful book of poetry, it would be a failure. I love to read poetry, but I'm not a poet. But I do know what I like and what really moves me as a reader and a writer, so I sort of stick to that lane.
You talk about so many different cases throughout just this time period. Why this particular story?
I grew up reading like To Kill a Mockingbird. And that was a story that had very similar themes, right? But it's a novel. I think probably if you asked Harper Lee, she was influenced by certain cases. I wouldn't actually be surprised if she was aware of this case, because some of the themes are just very similar in this. What I think was really interesting in this particular case was, when I started looking into it, I could not believe that I had not heard of this before. Nobody had heard of this story before. This involved Thurgood Marshall, future U.S. Supreme Court Justice. And, you know, everybody's familiar with the Scottsboro Boys. That's in 1931 in Alabama. But this story happens 10 years after that. Oh, 20 years after that, right? 20 years later in Florida. And nobody knows about it. And why is that? Four people were killed in the middle of this case. It's so much more dramatic than the Scottsboro Boys story. And yet, I think it had something to do with the fact that the story takes place in Florida. And Florida, people didn't look at that as the South. You know, you think about the Cotton Belt South, Louisiana, Mississippi, Georgia. Things were happening in Florida like, that's not the South. That's like Miami. It's the Sunshine State. That's not the... So a lot of these stories just were off the radar of public consciousness. You know, granted, the stories made headlines at the time, but they're not remembered. And I could not believe that, like, Thurgood Marshall is the Atticus Finch of this story, and he's down there, and, you know, they're killing the people he works with, chasing them out of town. It was so much more dramatic. And so I was just absolutely shocked that no one had known this story. I was reading, like, biographies of Thurgood Marshall. It's like, you know, a couple paragraphs. Because... Well, Thurgood Marshall had a great storied career. He did these landmark civil rights cases, and then he becomes the U.S. Supreme Court Justice. People didn't know that he was doing death penalty cases in the South, you know. So I think it was just a part of, he had a very rich life, but it was a part that was being ignored. And I'm interested in crime. I think you can take a crime story and learn an awful lot about America, whether it's race, history, law, economics, everything. If you use a crime story to sort of move people through it, you know, that lens of just, well, what's happening now? And that you come away with it, you close the book, and wow, I learned a lot about the Jim Crow South. I learned a lot about what the law looked like back then, the history. I think it's just a great way of delivering history through a strong narrative. And you know, crime, people are always interested in crime because it involves injustice and freedom, loss of freedom, life and death. And so I think instead of just writing a very dry textbook about the law and about race, use a crime story and you can still bring in all these other elements and people will come away smarter.
So in order to get the opportunity to interview you, our local library held an essay contest. My essay was based about Martin Luther King Jr.'s quote about the moral arc of the universe and how inevitably it'll be bending towards justice. How do you believe the arc is bending?
I like to believe that. I think that's the way things should be. But, you know, unfortunately, especially with these kind of civil rights stories, you can see the resistance to change. And so a lot of times, you know, you cover these trials and there just simply is no justice. And I'm picking stories because I want to identify with these, I guess you could call them heroes, but whether they're lawyers or journalists who are trying to, you know, right a wrong, you know, sometimes there isn't any justice. Sometimes you don't get a victory, but I think it's also important to realize that every little thing, and I'm talking about in terms of civil rights, every little thing builds towards another thing. So Emmett Till is killed in 1955. A young man who's just, you know, victim of racism and lies, and you know, they have the trial, and the trial's just a travesty of justice, and there's acquittals. There's no justice there. But when you look at what happened with Emmett Till and his mother, she had an open casket for her son, and that got so much publicity. And people around the country began to look at this and say, what kind of country do we want to live in that we're killing, you know, 14, 15-year-old boys violently like this? So maybe you don't get the verdict that you want in court, but you're reaching a consciousness of an America. And so all of a sudden, people became more attuned to what was happening and some of the atrocities that was happening. So they are little victories. And those are victories of the press, covering these stories, getting them out there and into the consciousness of a country that just finds these things are unacceptable. We don't want to be that country. And so I think it's sometimes you have to expect the fact that, you know, maybe you're not going to get justice, but maybe it really does bend toward justice. It might take decades, though. And I think that's what I find in a lot of these cases. There's no victories in the courts. Sometimes they get to a higher court. But, you know, people are getting killed along the way. But I think it's all building towards something. As long as you have people out there fighting for these changes, and these changes are real and righteous, it is that moral, you know, universe and bending towards justice. It just takes longer.
So my essay was on the point of view of Norma Padgett during that time, and I tried to understand the pressure that she was under to accuse the boys, how she was a white woman and she was just pressured to basically be racist, you know. So my question for you is, if you were a white male in that time period, do you think that you would have been pressured to be prejudiced towards African Americans? Do you think you would have been forced to be racist because of the social norms of that time?
I think the pressure on you to do these, to go along with the community, and there's a photograph in the book that I really find really interesting. It's a picture of a young man, Lawrence Berthoft, the man who was in the cafe who said Norma Padgett came in that morning, and he had a conversation with her for 15 minutes or so, And if you look at the photograph, you can see Sheriff Willis McCall and Deputy James Yates just staring at him. And the reason they're staring at them, if you know what's happening in that photograph, the prosecutor, Jesse Hunter, is interviewing him. And he's telling what happened. He said she didn't seem upset. And Jesse Hunter, the prosecutor, is saying, no, don't you remember? You saw her with a ripped dress standing outside your cafe, and she was calling for help. Don't you remember? And they were trying to influence his testimony. And he had talked to his mother about it, and the mother said, whatever happens, just tell the truth. If they're going to run Dad's, you know, cafe and run him out of town, we'll deal with that, but I want you to tell the truth. And so he decided to tell the truth. And but you can feel the pressure on him, you know, those violent, you know, sheriffs and deputies just glaring at him. And that's the kind of pressure that's on the white community. Thurgood Marshall has a really great quote, and I didn't really fully understand it until I really dug into these kind of stories. He said, racism benefits no one. And I remember thinking when I first saw that, I said, kind of a dumb quote, because, you know, racism has benefited white people for centuries.
But what he was really talking about was something much more specific. In order to prop up this system of white supremacy, there are going to be compromises, and white people are going to be destroyed by this too. And if you look in these stories, you have, you know, a white lawyer who decides to represent black people, basically run out of town, not giving you any work. You can't, there's no room for you in that space. Journalists who decide to write the truth instead of just going along, they're run out of town. And this happens over and over. And one of the most interesting things is after the pardon of the Groveland boys, which was this year in January, the Orlando Sentinel wrote a front page editorial apologizing for their coverage of this story, saying, "We got it wrong. We were basically being mouthpiece of white supremacists." And they were writing these stories because that's what the community wanted. They didn't want a story of four wrongly accused men and the honor of Norma Padgett being questioned. They wanted a story of the strong sheriff. And so that was the narrative that lingered. One of my greatest regrets in Devil in the Grove is that Norma Padgett didn't want to speak with me. She's still alive. And she did not want to speak with me. Her message to me was, "Let sleeping dogs lie." I feel the book would have been better if she would have talked to me. I felt like I was extraordinarily sympathetic for this reason. She's a 17-year-old girl who's married, and this story was not hers. This was a story that was put in place, and it was the men in her life, from her father to her husband to the prosecutor to the sheriff, who took this case from her. So once these accusations are made, this story is put into place, she has a certain role to play, and that is to show up in court and to point to the people, and just that's her job. But this story was taken away from her. This became the sheriff's narrative and the prosecutor's narrative and her husband's narrative and her father's narrative. And she became a victim in this story for those reasons. And so I always had a great deal of sympathy. I don't think that a 17-year-old girl is capable of igniting all this violence and hatred. I believe it was the men in this story. They were the ones with power. And, you know, they used the accusations. And really, what did they do for her life? They put her in the spotlight and made her live with this story for all these years. And, you know, to me, that's just a great tragedy. I really would have loved to talk to her about what it was like to go through a trial that everyone's paying attention to. What is it like living in this community where there are certain expectations of you? What was your life like? I would have liked to have flushed that out a little bit more. So that was my deepest regret. And, you know, I understand why she didn't want to talk. She hasn't spoken really to anybody in 70 years about it.
So in Lake County to this day, have you been back and visited where the Groveland boys and their incident took place?
I've been back many times. I've spent, you know, the last 10 or 11 years down there working, and so I go down. I do sometimes do book talks. The book I wrote after this, Beneath the Ruthless Sun, I had to go back to that same community and re-interview people that I'd spoken to before and just learn as much as I could. But yeah, I do go back a lot, and it's interesting now. I think there's sort of a level of respect that I get, that they've recognized that I'm not trying to exploit anything. I'm just really sticking to the truth. And so even people who are portrayed negatively, I guess, in the book, or things that are exposed, nobody really gives me much grief. Like, it's not, I don't get the fake news thing, or that, you know, you're making up your facts. It's all documented. And so, you know, I've had a lot of families come up to me and say, "My dad's in your book. He didn't really come out looking too good, but you got that right." You know, and so I feel a really great responsibility to make sure that I'm not just telling stories where it's black and white, good versus evil. There's a lot of interesting areas in the gray areas of this, and so that's what I find that's really interesting as a reader. Really complex things. You know, sometimes you'll have a deputy who appears to be doing the right thing, and he's standing up to his fellow deputies, but then you recognize that he might have the same kind of thoughts about race, and he may not be as enlightened, but, you know, he did make a choice that saved somebody's life, and so you have to sort of honor that and put that into context. Does that outweigh the fact that he might use some racial words in his life? I think it does. I mean, I think, you know, his actions, he risked his career and his life to turn in fellow deputies who were, you know, really fabricating evidence, and it could have led to executions of innocent people. And so I think you have to look at the characters. Like Thurgood Marshall's not a perfect person either. That's life. Life is complicated. I think they're just interesting stories to tell, and if everyone was an angel and everyone was a devil, it's not that interesting. And that to me, it's like the nonfiction, you're able to exploit and explore those gray areas that make it really interesting.
I did read an article earlier this year about Norman Paget, and it was from the Orlando Sentinel, and they were talking about how she's still sticking to the testimony that she gave years ago, that she still accuses these boys of raping her. How do you feel about that position?
Well, you know, I think in some of these cases, you have people as they get older and they start to just come clean a little bit. And you saw it in the case of Emmett Till, the woman who accused her of him whistling and making a pass. She later came out like 2 years ago and said that was all a lie. And I guarantee you that wasn't her lie. I think it was the men around her who forced her into this. We want to get rid of somebody. We want to, you know, do a little housekeeping and level this threat on a community that this is not acceptable. And so lies get put into place all the time. One of the things about Norma, I don't know how she really feels about this, or if it's just a story that she just cannot let go of and it would just be too painful to really come clean. If she almost maybe believes it at this point, I don't really know. One of the things that was really important to me when it came down for the clemency hearing is that it not be a case of he said, she said. I wanted that when this case came before the clemency board in January of this year, I thought it was really important that it not come down to this two versions, which one do we believe? What I thought was really important is that we look at what happened in that trial and the manufacturing of evidence, the perjury, the lying, the prosecutorial misconduct. Those are the reasons that I felt that these men should be exonerated, because the prosecution got away with framing these guys for rape. And that to me was the great crime. And I think we need to focus on what happened in that courtroom, because those are the kind of things we can hold people accountable for. Whether or not Norma Paget wants to, you know, support the pardon or fight it, I wasn't really interested in that. My personal belief is that Norma Paget is a victim in this story, and I feel that there are forces coming down on her that really enabled this story to take away. Four people lost their lives in this story. I cannot blame that on a 17-year-old girl. I believe it was the sheriff, the prosecutor, and the family that made that possible.
So when you were writing Devil in the Grove, would you ever find yourself getting angry at the people like Sheriff Willis V. McCall or Norma Paget for what they did or didn't do to help the Groveland boys?
You know, I think I went through this. There's definitely times where I would just sit down and go, I cannot believe what I'm reading here. I mean, this really happened. There's times that I feel that. But I think, you know, I always tried to focus on the most important part of my job is to sort of gather all this information and then craft it in a way that I'm telling a story. So I'm thinking in terms of professional ways. I try not to allow myself to get too overcome with emotion, because I want the facts and the reality to speak for itself. I don't want to be in there trying to manipulate people's feelings. I feel like some of these stories are so powerful on their own that it's almost more effective if I just back off and just document everything that happened and let people say, that is horrible. And people tell me these books make them so angry. And, you know, I would love actually maybe someday to write a book where people are just moved to tears and inspired and not get so angry. I've had many people tell me they throw my books across the room while they're reading it. And like, I always think like, hope it's not a Kindle, you know, but I also recognize, like, I know what the deal is. I know what this story is about, and it is going to make people angry, and that can be a good thing. That can, you know, force change sometimes. So I recognize the power in that. Sometimes it's not the most, you know, I guess, you don't want to pick up a book and say, I can't wait to get mad tonight, right? Who wants to do that? So, you know, there's challenges about this, but I just... you know, I'm a little bit older now. These are the stories I want to tell. I'm not trying to write a book about wizards. I'm not the right guy to do that. Mm-hmm. I love to read those books, but you know, I just know what my things are, and they're not always comfortable.
Did you ever feel like you were stereotyped by anyone when you were writing the story, or have you ever felt like you were being stereotyped when you were in the South?
Maybe. I think, you know, a lot of it is like, here's this white guy from New York City and he's coming down south. Like, we kind of seen that before, right? You know, during the civil rights movement, these do-gooders coming down into the South and trying to tell us how to live our lives. And there's a certain resentment to that. You know, I was always just very careful about just making sure that I'm here to listen to you and I'm going to talk about things. And, you know, if you want to talk to me, that would be great. And I think you just build up trust by being down there. I wasn't like a journalist who's coming down for maybe a day or two and getting a story and going out and writing it and then it's all forgotten. They saw me there every day, and I was working on this for years. So I would be in the same cafes talking to people, and I became like a fixture in the community. And so while they see their friends talking to me, why don't I talk to them? And so, yeah, there's probably some of that stereotype stuff, but I think, you know, just building trust and just showing people that I'm really here to learn from you, and you tell me what you want. If you want your story told, tell me what it is. I'm not going to change it to fit my agenda. I like to think I don't have an agenda, but the truth is, I think in this kind of writing, you do have an agenda. And the agenda is, you know, I think something really wrong happened in this case, and I'm going to try and really reopen this narrative. The official narrative is not correct. And, you know, I can point to real evidence that shows prosecutorial misconduct, fabrication of evidence, perjury. The state was lying. The using the awesome power of the state to spread a false narrative, I find like that to me is just, it just shakes me to my core. And I feel like a great responsibility to go down there and say, this part of it was wrong. And I'm going to prove it. I'm going to look at the documents and show how you lied about this, and show how this case was a great injustice. And so it, I think people really got that. And I there were a lot of people that I think were, you know, maybe a little bit hesitant to talk to me. And, you know, I have conversations and, you know, explain to them what I found, show them documents, and they go, that's just wrong. They could see it too. I mean, it was just obvious. And so I think, you know, just by being there and being willing to listen, being empathic, I think, you know, it's really important. I've interviewed a lot of white supremacists, people who admitted to me that they were in the Ku Klux Klan, people who admitted to me that they've killed people. And you're sitting there, and it's still a human being across from you, and you listen. And you know, granted, sometimes there's no remorse there either. And those are just really powerful conversations. And, you know, one of the most awkward things, I think, in these kind of conversations is, you know, you go back and you listen to your own tape recorder and of your interview, and you think, wow, this guy is not just a racist, he's a killer. And I'm sitting there just saying, tell me more, tell me more. And you feel like, wow, am I exploiting this person? He knows I'm writing a book. You know, I came to find out he was actually dying, and he was getting a lot of things off his chest at this point. And this is in the next book I did, Beneath the Ruthless Sun. So he was talking about things that he just really wanted to confess about, but, you know, really awful, painful stuff. And, you know, it's not uncommon that this happens. And, you know, maybe that will happen with Norma Padgett.
Do you ever feel like, as a white man not experiencing these racial injustices, do you ever feel like you need to sometimes check your privilege or try and think about this situation in a new light when you're writing these books?
You know, I think one of the most important things is getting feedback from communities. And one of the things I feel like when you, sometimes if you're writing a novel about stories, you might be appropriating someone's stories and using them. I feel what I'm doing is an investigation into the criminal justice system and America itself, and I'm exposing some of the wrongdoings and some of the injustices. And you cannot really write about injustice in America without really talking about race, because there's been one race that has taken the brunt of this since the original sin of slavery. And so I don't really feel that I'm going in and sort of writing from a perspective where I'm going to take these stories and tell the stories of the Groveland boys. I feel like really, honestly, this story is about Sheriff Willis McCall and how somebody like that can exist in this country. And by looking at all the machinations and all the people from the governor to the U.S. attorney to the judges and the lawyers who covered him and allowed him to continue doing these kind of things, this brutality and this racism, and by exposing this, that will be the power of the book. And so while the book, it is about the Groveland boys and their story and justice, I feel like that wouldn't be my lane to go into that area and get into their heads and you know, do it that way. My story is really a look at a person like Willis McCall and how does he exist. And of course, because I cover everybody, I'm covering all the lawyers, the Groveland boys, Norma Paget, those sides of the families, the deputies. I want to bring them all in. But I feel like my mission in this is to expose the criminal justice system and some of the wrongs. And so I think I get really, especially from the African American community, they have been so supportive. They're like, keep showing this, keep telling this, because this is what happened. We lived through this. We know you're right. Keep doing it. And so that I draw the greatest inspiration from that when they are just egging me on, going, here's another story. Go tell this one. I'm like, I wish I had the documents to do that, but keep giving me stories. I will do them. Like, because, you know, it's a big investment of your time, 5 years. I've written two books now about Sheriff Willis McCall. That's 10 years of my life that this guy has been in my head for 10 years. I don't recommend that to anybody.
Do you have any authors or books that kind of inspired you to write the way you do now?
You know, I could say that when I was younger, I used to read stories that I didn't really think about this, but stories that really meant something to me when I was younger were like Count of Monte Cristo, Papillon, and I found out they're usually stories of like wrongly accused people who are sent away to prison and they're trying to either escape, because when you're younger, you want that adventure, you know, escaping from Devil's Island. How do we get off the island, you know? But that those stories stayed with me, the injustices. And I just think there's like nothing more powerful than someone who's like had their freedoms and liberties taken away from them for reasons that are completely unjust. And, you know, just being sent to an island or into a, you know, dank, dark cell. That to me is one of the great travesties in humanity, someone to lose their freedom, and especially when they're wrongly accused and you have a force like the government coming down and maybe, you know, through means of prosecutorial misconduct or perjury, going out and framing somebody. And I just think that there's another narrative to tell about that, and those stories really interest me. So I often go back to the classics, but I do read a lot, and I draw inspiration from modern novelists to, you know, historical fiction and just straight up nonfiction.
How has your life been affected since becoming a writer and publishing these books?
It's just been the greatest gift that I've ever received. It opened my world up to seeing things differently and being able to go down to like, you know, Cajun country in Louisiana and talking to people and hearing the stories and learning about these cultures. And I think, you know, when I was younger, I was a lot different from you. I was very focused on sports and I didn't really read as much. And I wasn't really attuned to the world when I was younger. So I came to writing fairly later in life, and it's just been a great awakening for me. And, you know, even at my age, I'm 57, I'm still learning things. I still love finding out new things. I love meeting people and sitting down and talking to them and, you know, hearing their stories and seeing how it can benefit the stories I'm trying to work and just learning from their experiences. I'll never get tired of that. And it's just been a great gift to be able to, you know, say I'm working on a new book. I would love to talk to you. And people will say, I would love to talk to you. I have a lot to tell. And it's just, you know, it gives me goosebumps to be able to be in those situations.
You go between chapters about Thurgood Marshall and then chapters about the Groveland boys and then about Sheriff McCall. How did you decide to set up the book that way?
You know, I think it comes from a lot of like reading and watching movies and sort of picturing how these stories play out in your head. And that's been like the thing where it's instinctual, I guess. I do outlines, and I remember one time
I saw that writers like to do index cards with characters and plot out their chapters. And I sat down and did that for a couple days. And then I was cleaning out my office about 2 years after I'd written the book, and I realized I just put them in a drawer. I never looked at them again. I did it once, but it was in my head, and I knew where the story was going. And, you know, obviously there's been some, you know, rewriting along the way, but mostly just instinctual and just from reading a lot of books and just getting a sense of how stories unfold. And you know, I don't always get it right. You know, sometimes I've had to go back and say, this is not working, and readjust. But I think, you know, for me, there's so much going on in this story. And I had, you know, I had Sheriff McCall and the justice system. And then, you know, then you go back to Lake County and, you know, they're being terrorized and bombed. And it just sort of lends itself, like, just keep asking yourself, what happens next? What happens next? And if it's nonfiction, you have the answer. And it's just trying to decide how to make this very readable for all, so that the readers don't get too confused. I tend to go off on little tangents here and there. I just feel like I like those tangents sometimes. I have friends who write books and they'll take a break and write about the history of guns. And like, there's only one gun in your book. Like, why are you doing that? But it's like, yeah, because I'm an author. I can do whatever I want, right? But, you know, you don't want to make a mistake and bore people. But I do feel like some of these side tangents, they might seem kind of irrelevant. But when you get to the end, you realize, oh, this is all coming together. Now I understand why you introduced that character or this particular story.
Okay, so what is the greatest lesson that you've learned throughout this? I mean, you've mentioned many things that you've learned, but is there any advice that you would give based on this lesson that you've learned to other people that want to be writers or do something similar to what you have done?
Yeah, I think that, you know, obviously there's the normal things like don't ever quit and persistence. And I think one of the most important things I've learned is that, you know, a lot of times, maybe, like, I don't have an academic background. I don't have a law degree. I actually didn't graduate college. And so I came a few credits short. And I had an opportunity to move to New York. Kind of wanted to be a writer, but I didn't know how to go about it. And so now I'm writing about these themes that are heavily involving race, history, law. And, you know, the question is, who are you to tell these stories? And I think one of the things I've learned is, like, here's why I can tell these stories, because I really care about these. These stories mean a lot to me, and I become obsessed with them. And I think what happens is, you know, as a writer, the blank page is in front of you, and you have total control over what goes on that page. And so you don't, it's like this meritocracy almost. You have control to put words on a page that can move people. And it doesn't matter what your background is. It doesn't matter that, you know, you don't have a law degree. I'm going to write about law. I'm going to ask the right people. I'm going to get this right. It'll take me a little longer than maybe a lawyer might, but I'm going to try and get these stories right. And I think if you just care and you're committed to them, that's the most powerful thing you have going for you. Find something that you really care about and pursue that. And so I always often think about that blank page. Every time you start a new book, you don't really know your story yet. You have to learn it all. And that's what's great. It's just this great optimistic moment of hope. Like, I can make something on this white piece of paper. And, you know, it's not, I don't have to be a carpenter and have gone to school and learn how to build. You can do it on your own. You can be out there taking classes, studying online. You can read. It's like an endless life journey to learn more. And so that's like the number one thing I think for me that's just helpful, is that I can control my own destiny because I'm a writer and the words are coming out of my head, and I just have to learn and be able to put that together.
What do you feel is America's next step toward equality?
Ooh. You know, on this question, I'm going to defer to a person I consider a hero, who's Bryan Stevenson. He is the founder of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. There's the Peace and Justice Memorial that he set up, the museum, Legacy of Slavery. I've been there twice, really phenomenally moving experience. It's kind of like going to the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C., and you see the names, and you see, as the war escalated, the names begin to rise up that wall. And this I experienced at the Lynching Museum. You have every county in the South, basically, in the United States. And there's these granite markings of people that were lynched. And it's a visceral experience, and it's really powerful. And Brian Stevenson has done so much work in this about, you know, just really educating people. And one of the things he talks about is truth and reconciliation. And if you look at, if you go back to, like, apartheid and the aftermath of apartheid, you had a government program that was about forgiveness. What we don't want, they were saying, is that these stories were going to disappear and that we were not going to acknowledge the truth. So they offered immunity to people who had done things in order that they tell the truth. And they documented all the atrocities. And that was a way of getting towards reconciliation. How do you move beyond that? Same thing you see in Nazi Germany. You can't go anywhere in Germany without seeing monuments, memorials, remembrances that this never happens again. They teach it in schools. I don't really think we have the same thing here in the United States. So in the aftermath of slavery, you have this narrative that begins to build about the inferiority of African Americans. And this narrative builds over through 100 years of Jim Crow, right through the Civil Rights Movement. And I think the problem that we've had in this country is that we haven't acknowledged the truth. And so it's really fallen on storytellers and lawyers to go back and look at these and expose these truths so that people are aware that these things really happened. These are the things that we inflicted on a race in the United States well after slavery, and we don't acknowledge it. And, you know, I want to believe that America is the greatest country in the world. I really want to believe that I live in a place that cares about this stuff. And we've kind of swept that under the carpet. And I think before you can really get to reconciliation, you need to get to the truth. And so these stories are really important to dig them out and to give voice to people. You know, the families of the Groveland boys, really remarkable people. I think they were really resistant to this story coming out in the very early parts of it. They didn't want to acknowledge this. And now they understand the importance of it. And they recognize that there can be some kind of reconciliation. The pardons, the government coming in and saying, we were wrong, we apologize for this, officially pardoned and eventually moving towards the full exonerations. And so I think that's just the most important thing, is for our society to just sort of recognize that this really happened and that we can be a better nation if we just acknowledge this and move on from it.
This is a little less of a serious question, but I'm just wondering what you do when you're not writing, if you have any hobbies or any books that you like to read.
Yeah, I mean, one of my big hobbies for a long time, although I get to do less of it now, is I love golf. And golf, I have to defend golf sometimes, but I'll give you an example of why I like golf. I think there's like philosophical things you can do. If maybe you're a writer and yoga is your thing, that might give you, you know, breathing exercises and spirituality. For me, I like to go out on golf courses by myself. Sometimes I'll just put headphones on and listen to music and walk through a beautiful setting by myself. And it seems like I'm playing golf and wasting time, but honestly, I'm thinking about these stories. And sometimes just getting out of an office and going for a walk in the woods and playing a little silly game with a little ball, it's almost like a meaningless exercise that gets you to think differently. And so I kind of built that into my schedule when I was writing Devil in the Grove. And you know, it's kind of funny because my wife would say to me, like, are you really playing golf every day? Don't you have a deadline? You're going out for 2 hours and playing. And, you know, I think she thought I was wasting time. And I tried to explain how important it was to the process and how I was able to think about things. And then, like, after the Pulitzer Prize, she was like, just do what you got to do. I don't care. You know? So I thought it was kind of funny. But since then, I really haven't been playing as much golf because I've just gotten busier. But one of my hobbies. Another hobby is I have a dog, and I've always had dogs in my life, and I just love going for walks with my dogs and taking to the park and walking around the city. There's all sorts of smells in Brooklyn, so that's my other hobby.
Is there anything else that I didn't mention that maybe you would like to talk about or to add to any of these questions?
That's a really good question. Here's one thing I think that, you know, when you do these kind of stories, sometimes they're very dark, and they can be really disturbing, and it's sort of, these are sometimes truths that sort of get buried because they're uncomfortable to talk about. I always end up going back to the people in these stories who didn't want these stories buried. people like Thurgood Marshall and these young African-American lawyers who really were risking their lives in order to save someone's life. And I just love hearing these stories and the personal journeys of like these young African-Americans who did everything right, and they couldn't go to law school in the South because there were no law schools that were open to African-Americans. So they'd often had to go up north and learn law there and then go back down to their communities where it was very hostile. They were met with a lot of resistance, and it was not a safe environment for them. There were people trying to kill them to fight because of their fight for equality and equal rights. And so I look at those people as just great American heroes. Those are American stories, and those stories deserve to be told. These were people fighting for something that was so basic, basically the Constitution, equal justice under law, and that's what they were fighting for. And you could see the resistance to that, and their lives were in danger, and, you know, people die in these stories. If you just talk about a resistance, and I often talk about Black Lives Matter. Well, these young lawyers were out in the forefront of that, and they were the ones fighting for that, and, you know, just trying to make sure that everybody, every citizen in America, enjoyed the same equal rights. And it wasn't that way in a lot of parts of America, and they were willing to die for that. So I just am struck by their bravery and their courage and their commitment.
Okay, thank you so much for coming to do this interview today and for talking to me. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your time and your answers today. It's really been a pleasure.
My pleasure, too. Thank you for the great questions.
Thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Support from the Tip City Foundation, Tippecanoe Educational Endowment, City Council member Frank Sienna and Heather Bailey, Tip City Rotary Club, 91.3 WYSO radio station, Dayton Literary Peace Prize made this event possible.